Okay, tonight is the 4th of October, year 2000. It's the 5th of Tishrei. Actually, by now it's dark enough, so it's the 6th of Tishrei already. I hope everybody had a very happy Yontif, and a good one. The Rabbeinu Shalom shall bless us all with a good year, and he shall give us gezunt and shalom, and all the things that we hope for. Amen. Last week I didn't have tape, and I'm not going to review everything that we did, but I think it would be a good idea just to summarize a couple of the highlights of the previous chapter that we completed last week. The third chapter, which has the official name of Rehuhu Bezdin, because the very first Mishnah dealt as a continuation of the fact about giving testimony concerning the new moon. But as we saw, as soon as we got beyond that particular Mishnah, from that particular time on, the Talmud of the Mishnah goes into the discussion of the character of the shofar. Okay? We saw number one, talking like Rabbi Sayyidi already. One, two, three. Okay? We saw that, first of all, what is the mitzvah par excellence, so to speak, for Rosh Hashanah? And the answer is, it is the blowing of the shofar. Okay. So that, therefore, we then went into a discussion about what is a valid shofar and what is not a valid shofar. We saw that, for example, can a shofar come from any kind of a horned animal? And of course, the answer is no. Because while it could come, for example, from animals that resemble sheep, goats, or something like that, but nevertheless, we ruled out what? We ruled out, for example, Korah, right? We ruled out, in other words, the horn of a bull or a cow or something like that. That is not, because, as we said, even though the word Karen is used for that, and sometimes the word Karen also refers to the shofar, but nevertheless, Karen is the term used, the horn of a bull or a cow or something like that, this is referred to only by the word Karen, whereas, for example, the horn of a ram is referred to as a shofar as well. So that, therefore, we learned that while you can blow from the horn of a, you know, of a ram or a goat or something like that, a wild mountain goat, you know, you see some of these curved things and so on. But nevertheless, the one par excellence, so to speak, is the horn of an isle, a ram. Why? Why? Why is the isle chosen?
Because Abraham.
Exactly. Because it reminds us of the Arkadas Yitzchak, okay, and that's the reason why that is considered the best.
What do you
okay.
call the horn when it's not used as a shofar?
Karen? No, you could call it a shofar if you want to, if
well,
it is
it's not
a shofar.
Until you use it as a shofar.
All right. But as an instrument, it still is a shofar, that's all. Okay. Yeah. But naturally.
But while it's still on the
Oh, then it's a cairn. It's a horn. It's a horn of an animal. So it is.
Okay.
The shofar means it's
so
already
Karen
been made into
common,
a shofar.
Name. Okay.
Correct.
Is the
right.
Karen on the altar?
Yes. Of course, the word Karen has various meanings. The word Karen can refer to a corner.
Yes.
And therefore, the corners of Mizbeach are the corners of the altar. On the altar itself, there were special corners that were raised higher than the area in which the fire was there, and so on and so forth. Okay? So that's Karen. Yeah, no, of course, correct. We have the word Karen in the sense of a ray of light. Yeah, Karen Or. And that's why I remember your neighbor, Charles Haywood. Right, he had that question about the translation that you have in St. Jerome over there. So I told him, you know, that that
the
there when it says right,
the,
right,
no, faith shown,
right. It says ki karan or panei
moshe.
Right, right. So we got that one straightened out too. Okay. So the word has different meanings. depending upon what the context is. This is true of many words, right? Even in English, we have cases like that. I mean, if I give you a word, S-A-W, saw. Yeah. So what am I talking about?
A verb, it could be a noun.
Right. It could be anything, but you have to know it in its context.
That's right.
I saw the debate last night. Okay. So that's one thing. But I need a saw, you know, to saw some wood or something like that. It's already a different story. Okay. So it happens in various languages that the same word may have different connotations depending upon the context in which it is used. Okay. So at any rate, we have determined then that the best one is from a ram, but it could be of any animal that is analogous to it. Okay. Secondly, we also learned that if there is an imperfection in it, the chances are it's invalid. For example, a hole, or it's split, and you can't put two shofars together and things like that and so on. Okay? You can't do that. Right. Or make it out of, you know, pieces of shofar that you glue together or something like that. Okay, that's out. And we learned that if the sound is interfered with in any way, as for example by a hole in there, then in that case it's also invalid. But if it would not interfere, then it may possibly be. Okay, we also learned that at the time of the Beis HaMikdash, that they actually used to decorate the mouthpiece around it, you know, with gold, but of course we don't do that anymore. And of course we also learned at the same time about the laws concerning the blowing of the trumpets as well in the Beis HaMikdash, Chatzotras, okay? And the use not just on Rosh Hashanah, but also on fast days, and of course, the Yom Kippur of Jubilee, okay? And that will recur again, because, you know, we'll see in this chapter that again they refer to the blowing of the shofar in the Jubilee year. Okay. Now, we also learned again that what is the mitzvah? Is the mitzvah the blowing of the shofar, or is it hearing the sound of the shofar? Of course, we learned that it is no.
Hearing.
It's the hearing which is the real mitzvah.
Well,
okay?
Blowing is hearing it.
Okay. But then we spoke about the idea about kavodah.
Yeah.
And the conclusion that they came to is that in reality it has to be a combination of kavana on the part of both the shomeya, the one who is listening to the sounds of the shofar, and the mashmiya, the person who is blowing the shofar, that they both have to have in mind that they want to fulfill the mitzvah of the blowing of the shofar. Okay, we learned if inadvertently you heard and if you decide at that time, okay, I want to be yotze, alright, you can be yotze, but if you have, you don't have in mind that you want to be yotze, you are for guys simply playing Yankee Doodle on the shofar, you understand, then in that particular case, in either case, there's no kavana that's involved, and therefore you cannot be yotze with it. So these are some of the things that we were discussing in the last couple of weeks. Okay, and then we dealt with some other things last week, which I'll mention only one, and that is that just as you have to have kavana that you want to fulfill the mitzvah of the sounding, listening to the sound of the shofar, so likewise Israel is victorious when it has the kavana, you know, that it wants to look up to heaven for help. Remember we read the Mishnah, which deals first of all with the story of the war against the Amalekites, when Moshe Rabbeinu had to hold his hands up, and when he held his hands up, so we saw that the people of Israel were victorious, but when he let them down, so they lost. And the Mishnah asked at that particular point, do you really believe that it was the hands of Moses that caused either victory or defeat for the people of Israel? The answer is no. But as long as the people of Israel, that they have their thoughts towards heaven, in other words, they want to submit to the will of God, they want to do that which is it, then the people of Israel are victorious. And if not, then they won't. And then the second case that they brought in was about the Nechash HaNechoshes, the serpent made of brass, which was put up at the time of when there was a plague of snakes, if you remember, that attacked the people of Israel. And so Moshe Rabbeinu was told to make a bronze serpent, and whoever would look upon it, would be healed. And again, the same question is asked. Do you think, that the bronze serpent really healed? But again, as long as people, pray to God that he should be the Rofei Chole Amo Yisrael, that he should be the one to heal the ill among our people, then, they can be helped. But if they have no faith in God, then in that case it's not going to help. And I mentioned incidentally that there's a Gemara in several places in the Talmud, including in Psachim and so on, about King Hezekiah, that they praised him for some things and condemned him for other things. One of the things that they praised him for is that he broke into pieces the Nechash HaNechoshes, because people had made it into a form of idolatry, right? And he wanted to make sure that people would not fall into that habit, and so he destroyed it. And the Chachamim Hodulo, which means that they praised him for this particular thing. Alright. Now, we're about to start the fourth and the final chapter in Maseches Rosh Hashanah. Okay? We are right now on Chav Tes, Omid Beis, alright? 29b. New chapter.
New chapter.
Right over here. That's the new chapter, okay? Now, what the first Mishnah deals about is something that historically took place years ago, but it has reference to us, because just this past Shabbos we had the fact that Rosh Hashanah, the first day, fell on Shabbos. Okay, so the Mishnah begins by telling us that Yom Tov shall Rosh Hashanah shachol yos b'Shabbos. If it is the Yom Tov of Rosh Hashanah and it occurs on Shabbos, so it says ba'mikdosh hoyu tokin. Then they used to blow shofar in the Beis HaMikdosh, even though it was Shabbos, okay? Aval lo b'mendina, but not outside of the temple precinct, okay? Seems simple so far, right?
Yeah.
But now, here comes a historical event. The Shachar of Beis HaMikdosh, after the temple was destroyed, Hiskin Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, so Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai made an enactment, I guess about the best translation for Hiskin. He made an enactment, or he enacted, okay? Sheyuhu tokin b'chol makom sheyesh bo bezdin. That they should blow shofar wherever there was a bezdin. Now, of course, this already leads to a big problem, because the question is, number one, what do we mean by a bezdin? Because you have all kinds of bezdins. Gomorrah in Sanhedrin, of course, begins in the first chapter by defining what are the different types of batei din that there are, different types of bezdins that are in existence. One of them is the Sanhedrin Gedola, which consisted of 71 members, and that, of course, was like the Supreme Court, that was the preeminent bezdin for the people of Israel. Okay, then you had in various localities a bezdin of Esra Mishlosha, 23 people, okay, which was empowered, among other things, to deal with those cases which would involve capital punishment. And then you have a bezdin of three, where it deals with ordinary matters. I mean, if I'd say divorce, marriage, property problems, people disputing wills and partnerships, and the ordinary reason why you have a bezdin, in order to make peace between people by hearing their tithes and coming to some kind of a conclusion, to support either one or the other, or maybe make a peshara, maybe make a compromise between them to which both parties will agree. So what kind of a bezdin are we talking about over here? The answer is that what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai probably had in mind, and I say only probably because we're not here to ask him, was probably a Sanhedrin Gedola. Because what was one of the things that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai did? he wanted to make sure that there would be continuity after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Where did the Sanhedrin Gedolah meet prior to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash? The answer is, they had a separate chamber within the temple precincts. Okay? It was called the Lishkas HaGozis. It was called, literally, the Chamber of Hewn Stone. Okay? Because, you know, the floor is probably made of hewn stone. And this is where the Sanhedrin Gedolah met. And as long as they were there, they were, as I say, the Supreme Court. We have a Gemara that says that 40 years before the destruction of the temple, they already saw that there was going to be problems, and so they moved out of the Lishkas HaGozis and they went to some other area, but they still continued to exist. Okay? Now, when that happened, they moved out of Lishkas HaGozis, then certain things, certain types of capital punishment could no longer be effective, because it was only while they were sitting in the Lishkas HaGozis that they could condemn a person to death. Of course, I don't have to tell you, we learned in the Gemara and Marcus, when we learned it, that a Bezdin that that condemned a person to death, according to Rabbi Akiva, even once in 70 years, was considered that this was the Bezdin of the murderers, he said. Right. So
there's no record that
it was on, right. It was on the books, but rarely enforced. Right, rarely enforced. Okay. Now, when the temple was destroyed, Rabbi Yochanan and Zaki was the great hero of trying to save Judaism. Gemara and Gittin has a dramatic story of how he had himself smuggled out of Yerushalayim in the last days when the Romans were about, to destroy the city. And he was there together. He was carried as a dead corpse by his two preeminent Talmidim, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkanus and Rabbi Yoshua ben Chananya. And then he came to the camp of the Romans, and he hailed Vespasian, who was the general of the Roman army, as king, as emperor, Caesar, okay? And Vespasian took offense. He thought that he was making fun of him, but also he wanted to know, well, why haven't you come before in order to make peace with me? So at any rate, at the moment, when he was ready to punish Akiva, to punish Rabbi Yochanan and Zakkai for calling him Caesar, Caesar, you see, that's because in Latin, the C is not a S, it's a K sound, okay? In other words, the Romans probably pronounce it Caesar, okay? Julius Caesar, okay? And then Caesar became.
I didn't know that he was Jewish.
Yeah.
Julie,
right?
Ankle.
Right. And then emissaries from Rome arrived, and they told Vespasian that the emperor was dead, and the Senate had appointed Vespasian as the new emperor of Rome. So,
as a result of that,
he said to Rabbi Yochanan and Zakkai, ask me any favor and I'll give it to you. Okay? So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, all that I want is to be able to establish a yeshiva in a little town called Yavne. Okay? And then he also said, let the dynasty of Rabbi Gamliel be spared. Rabbi Gamliel was a descendant of Hillel, they had the Bezdin. So actually, he was one of those who was the martyr, but he wanted at least the family to be permitted to be alive, to carry on the tradition. And then there was a sage who had prayed that Jerusalem should be spared and fasted for 40 years. His name was Rabbi Tzadok. So obviously he was very thin and near death, so he asked for a physician in order to cure him. Those were the three things he asked. So, of course, for Vespasian, obviously this was a mishugan, a request. He could have given him gold, silver, title, a face, at about the same time, Yosef ben Matisyahu decided, to go over to the Roman side, and so he was given the name as Josephus Flavius. Flavius being the family name of Vespasian and Titus and so on, okay? So And of course, he was well rewarded for his work as being a flack for the Romans. I mean, he wrote the Jewish history, which generally is favorable to the Romans and not so favorable to the Jews, you know. So, at any rate, this was not what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai did. What Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai wanted was permission to open up a yeshiva. And this patient, what does he know about yeshiva? A couple of Altaim get together and they want to take a look at a Gemara or something like that. Okay, so let him do so. This was the saving of Judaism. But it was the saving of Judaism because Yochanan ben Zakkai was able to face every emergency that people said, for example, what point is there to live anymore? We don't have a Beis HaMikdash, we can't give sacrifices, what are we going to do? So he went on the basis of two things. One is the fact that we mustn't forget what life was like as long as we had a Beis HaMikdash and try to retain as much of it as we possibly can. Okay? And the other is that he kept hoping that Behero Yibona Beis HaMikdash, that speedily the time would come and the temple would be rebuilt. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. We're still praying that the Behero Yomena should happen in our own days. It hasn't happened as yet. Yes?
How many temples did they have?
In Yerushalayim?
Yes.
There was the first temple.
No, I'm not talking about that.
And the second temple.
They came in with 600,000 people.
Not from Babylonia, they didn't.
No, I'm talking about when they built the first temple.
Ah, okay, the time of King Solomon.
Right.
Yeah.
The population must have been a lot more than 600,000.
Yes, it was, absolutely.
It must have been more like a
couple
of millions.
Yes, right.
Did they all come to the Beis HaMikdash?
They all had to come to the Beis HaMikdash for pilgrimages and things like that.
But
right.
In
their own place, they were probably places not where they were permitted to sacrifice, but where they could gather in order to daven or something.
That's what I'm asking.
Yeah, yeah.
What time period?
We don't know exactly when synagogues. Some say that synagogues were already in existence in the time of the first Beis HaMikdash. And I don't see any reason why not. Because the people want to gather, I mean, and, you know, to pray.
Get a couple of million people.
Right, exactly. Right. And those who say, it couldn't have been in the first temple because we don't have any great references to it, but we certainly know that in the time of the second temple, there were already synagogues.
They
think that the
Babylonia
institution started in Babylonian exile, exactly. That this was the substitute for the temple.
Yeah.
And they based it, of course, upon a pasuk that we have in the book of Ezekiel, in Yechezkel, where he says, Vahilahem lemikdash me'at. God says, I have been unto them like a small sanctuary. Okay? Meaning that, you know, wherever Jews gather together in order to pray and so on and so forth, so this is like a little temple, so to speak. And of course, you know, in our own life, even our own home is supposed to be something, you know, like a room in the Beis HaMikdash, so to speak. I mean, that when we, the table is supposed to represent the Mizbeach and so on. Exactly, right. So you make a bracha or something, it's as though, you know, you're actually carrying on this tradition. David. Oh, well, okay.
And of course, and during the, kingdom of Israel split off, you had
All right. Let's take just each of them just for one moment. Okay. The people of Israel had a Mishkan, right? They had a tabernacle, which they kept with them during the years that they wandered, and then they took their Israel and they had it over there. It was in different places, depending upon where it was safe from attacks from the enemy. Okay. And then we finally come to the time when the Philistines were threatening the people of Israel. And at that time, we read that the Mishkan was located in Shiloh. Okay. And this is where we had the story that we read in the Haftorah, the first day of Rosh Hashanah, about Chana coming in order to pray that she should have a child. She came to Shiloh And there Eli HaKohen was the high priest. Okay. That was destroyed when the Israelites fought a battle against the Philistines. And the Philistines, you know, not only were they victorious, but they also destroyed Mishkan Shilom. Okay? They destroyed it.
That was one that came out of the desert.
And they captured, if you remember, the Ark of God, and they had it first in Philistine territory for some time, and then finally decided to return it to the Jews, because there were all kinds of plagues that began to afflict the Philistines. They said, why do we need this Surah? Give it back to them.
Why did they deliver it to them?
Well, there was in Beit Shemesh, there was other places and so on that they were located, and finally, and it stayed in the house of a family until finally King David decided that the time had come in order to bring it back to Yerushalayim. Okay.
That was all
right. Yes.
Most conservative temples today call it temple so and so.
Yeah.
But the Orthodox, we don't use the temple to begin with.
We shouldn't. I'll tell you why. Because from the Orthodox point of view, the only temples were the first temple and the second temple. That's it, the Beis HaMikdash. Anything else is a synagogue. When the Reform movement started, they decided to call their place temple. Why did they do that? Two reasons. First of all, it was fancy for the goyim. Fancy for the goyim. I was in France. I studied in France one summer. Okay. You had église, which is the French word for a church, and then you had the word temple. T-E-M-P-L-E. It's like English word temple, okay? Temple. What was the difference between them? Eglise was the Catholic Church. That's the official church, okay? Temple was for the Protestants. Believe it or not, they have a few Protestants also in France, you know. From the time of the Huguenots and so on, they have.
They still have.
So here and there you find, right. So they call their places temple, okay? Yeah, they have some. Yeah, I came across them when I was studying in France. Okay. So, in other words, this was a nice fancy word that was already in use. Okay. And so the Reform decided we'll call our place temple. Okay. But there was another reason also why they called it temple. They called it temple also to show that they did not need a temple in Jerusalem. What? Wherever they were in Germany, this was it. This was the sanctuary, and as one of them put it, you know, the Rhine is our Jordan. The Rhine is our Jordan. Okay. So this is the reason why.
Do any Orthodox synagogues use the word temple at all?
If they have a fancy ladies auxiliary who called it that, I come across one or two, not too many. Baruch Hashem. Right. But with the conservative, the answer is that they tanzen off the Reform. I mean, whatever the Reform were doing, they decided that they had to be just as fancy, so that's why they called them temple. You understand? Strictly speaking, it should be Bethel Synagogue. Doesn't sound fancy enough. So that's why it is Temple Bethel. Okay.
All right, yep.
Nope. What shall I say? Jews in the Tamsen noch. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Sorry for that.
So, that being the case, we see now in this part of the Mishnah that after the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai made an enactment, Sheyuhu tokim bechol mokom sheyesh bo besdin, that they should blow shofar wherever there was a besdin. Now the question is, did he have in mind only the fact that because he had a Besdin of 23 in Yavne, in order to keep alive the tradition of a court of 23, or did he mean that where any Besdin? This is undecided, I have to tell you, at this moment, okay? This moment is undecided, okay. But as we can see, he wanted to carry on the tradition of the Beis HaMikdash and to assert the authority of the Sanhedrin that he had in his yeshiva in Yavne. You understand? This is what it is. It's a matter of sovereignty also. So, as a result, he made a decree saying that they should blow shofar there even if Rosh Hashanah fell on Shabbos. Okay? Omer Rav Yelosa,
yes. Only in Yavda.
Only in Yavda. That was his decree. Okay? But Omer Rav Yelosa, so Rav Yelosa came along and he says, Lo hiskin Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai ela b'Yavdin bilvad. He says, no, this decree doesn't apply anywhere outside of Yavda where there is a Sanhedrin, but only in Yavda. So Omer Lo, so the sages that were there gave a rejoinder and they said, no, that's not what he meant. He said, Echod Yavda, the Echod kol mokim sheyesh bo bezna. Right. Makes no difference. Yavda and any other place where there is a bezna. All right, so this is where the Mishnah stands right now. Then the Mishnah continues and it says, the od zos, or yisoy Yerushalayim yisoy ad Yavda. He says, now, since we're talking about the fact that the Beis HaMikdash, there they blew shofar on Rosh Hashanah, so Yerushalayim had preeminence over other places in another respect as well. In what respect? So he says, Shekol ir shehi ro'o v'shoma'as v'krova v'yakola lo'no token, that in every city which is right near Yerushalayim, where they could actually see Yerushalayim from there, and they could also hear the sound of a shofar coming out of Yerushalayim over there, and it's nearby, obviously, v'yakola lo'no, and at the same time it is possible to, you know, to take a walk from this place to Yerushalayim without violating Shabbos or Yom Tov, right? So in that particular case, Tokin, in those places too, you're permitted to know. So in other words, there were suburbs, let's say, very close by to Yerushalayim, where it would be permissible to blow shofar on Shabbos. Okay? If, as I say, they have to meet the criteria that they are able to see Yerushalayim. In other words, if there was, let's say, a mountain that obstructed the view, then in that case, that's out, right? Or they could hear the sounds of the shofar over there. If it's too far away that they couldn't hear the sound, then in that case, that also excluded that area, okay? And if it's too far away that you couldn't walk to Yerushalayim, then that would also exclude it, okay? So under those provisions, if it was close enough, so then they were permitted to blow shofar in Yerushalayim, right? Uvi Yavne, but in Yavne, lo hayu token el bebezdim vat. There they blew the shofar only in the bezdim and no place else. Alright, so far the Mishnah sounds pretty easy to understand. We see that Yochanan ben Zakkai says, okay, in the Beis HaMikdash they did blow shofar on Shabbos, right? And therefore, where there is a legitimate bezdin in existence, then we want to keep alive this tradition of blowing shofar on Shabbos, and so he gave permission for it. But as we see already from the end of the Mishnah, that it was limited only to the bezdin of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai in Yavd. Okay. Although, as we see, you know, there is not unanimous agreement in that respect. So the Gemara now asks the following question, okay? It says, Minohani Mile. It says, how do we know that either you are permitted or you're not permitted to blow shofar on Shabbos? This is the question. You understand? How do we know? Do we have any place in the Torah where there's a reference to it? So Omer Rabbi Levi Bar Lachma. So Rabbi Levi, the son of Lachma, said, Omer Rabbi Chana Bar Chanina, in the name of Rabbi Chama Bar Chanina, and he said, Kosev Echad Omer Shabbason Zichron Trua, Kosev Echad Omer Yom Trua Yelanochem. He says, we have two different psukim in the Torah dealing with Rosh Hashanah. In one case, it says that Rosh Hashanah is, okay, Shabbason, it is a Sabbath day, meaning it's a day upon which there's to be no activity, right? It's a day which is sacred to God. And Zichron Trua, it's a day for the remembering of the sound of the shofar. Okay? That's one pasuk. And another pasuk says, Yom Trua Yelechem, it is a day for the blowing of the shofar. Okay. And he says, Lokasha. Says there's not a contradiction between the two verses. Why is there no contradiction? Because he says, Kan be Yom Tov Shechol Yos B'Shabbos, and Kan be Yom Tov Shechol Yos B'Chol. He says, in the first case, if it is Yom Tov occurring on Shabbos, then in that case, what pasuk applies to it? The answer is the one about Zichron Trua, remembering that there is such a thing as shofar blowing. Okay? Right. And if it's a weekday, then in that particular case, it's Yom Tov, it's the day which you're permitted to blow the shofar. And Taka, this is the way we, this is what we do today. I mean, this is the established custom today to do that. Okay? But you know, they asked the question now about his reasoning. Omar Rava, Rava said as follows, he says, Imido Raisa hi Mikdo Sheikh Takinam. If you tell me that the Torah says that on Shabbos you're not allowed to blow shofar, so how come they permitted it in the Beis HaMikdash? Behold, furthermore, he says, Holav Melacha says, you know, it's not considered an actual Melacha, okay?
A forbidden Melacha.
Yeah, okay, well, this is what I have to explain right now. What do we mean by Melacha? In the Ten Commandments, we are told, Kol Melacha Leisasu, and so on. Of course, many of the holidays, too, it says that, okay. You're not allowed to do any Melacha, okay? Doesn't use the word avoda, which is also a word which means a labor, work, and so on. You understand? So, the Gemara in Shabbos tells us that the word melacha is connected with the building of the Mishkan. The building of the Mishkan is written over there. It's meleches machshavos, which means literally work which requires planning in order to carry out. And what kind of planning was involved in the building of the Mishkan? The answer is you had to know carpentry, you had to be able to know how to make the to sew together the tapestries that were used over there, and you know, there were all kinds of melachas over there. Yeah, all kinds of things, okay? Including, of course, the problem about, you know, using fire on Shabbos, okay? So, all these different things form the basis of what we call the Lamedtes Melachas. In other words, what are the 39 major categories of prohibited work on Shabbos? So, it has to be in that particular nature. But, for example, to sit and to serve a food on Shabbos, this is not a melacha. This is avoda. You understand? So that, of course, is permitted to do. Obviously, after all, you want to eat. So that you can do. But, you know, again, you have to make sure that when you're ready to serve meals on Shabbos, that you're not doing any prohibited work in connection with the preparation. Okay. But, as I say, malacha is the term now that is being used to describe that type of an activity which the Torah has prohibited as involving the real nature of labor on Shabbos. Okay? Now, the question that he's raising over here is shofar blowing a melacha? And he says, no, it's not a melacha. He says, it's not a melacha. So that if it's not a melacha, then in that particular case, that's why it was permitted to blow shofar on Shabbos. So that's not the reason why we don't blow. Okay? We'll discover what the reason is a little bit later. Okay. Yes?
Hire a chazan for Yaakov, and he's earning money.
Right.
And he's davening for Yom. Isn't he working then?
Sure, he's working, but he's doing avodah. He's not doing melacha.
He's really fine to serve.
But he's paid for it. Really,
sure, he's getting paid, but you don't pay him on the spot.
No.
You pay him after Yotif, okay. Okay. All right. So he says, Olav Melachi, he writes, it's not a Melachi, he says, the Itzrich Kron Lemiyute, that, you know, I require a verse in the Torah in order to, let's say, to make an exception or something like this, that in the base somebody should permit. All right. The Tana Rabbi Shmuel, the Tana Devei Shmuel, as the school of Shmuel taught as follows, it says, Kol Meleches Avodah Lo Sasu, right? And they say, the Pasuk says, you're not allowed to do any kinds of Meleches Avodah, in other words, any kind of labor of this type. But Yotzesor, there is an exception in what? Tekiyas Shofar, the sounding of the Shofar, Uridiyas Hapas. Now, Uridiyas Hapas, this refers to the fact that in olden times, how did they bake bread? They baked it by sticking dough inside the oven, okay? Make a fire over there, and then when the dough had risen and become bread, so then they had to scrape it off the sides of it. So he's saying that this too is a permitted melacha. It's permitted to do that kind, because otherwise how are you going to eat bread if you can't do it, okay? So this he permitted. All right. So he says these are two exceptions, and this is, I say, a teaching of the school of Shmuel. Okay. What? Here is a circular oven. Okay, that's what they had in those days. Tanur. All right, and they would make a fire inside. Before they lit the fire, they would take dough and put it around the sides of the oven, inside, okay? And then they would light the fire and let it burn until the dough had, you know, become bread. I don't know, maybe it looked something like matzah, something like that, you understand? Yeah, obviously it didn't look like when you put it into a bowl and get bread that way, right? Right. Yeah. They scraped it off with their hand, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. No, nobody says that it was easy work. It was difficult work, but they wanted to eat, and that was the way that they did it, you know. You see, you have to bear in mind, they didn't have gas. They didn't have electric stoves. They didn't even have kerosene stoves. The bread was good. It was fresh when they ate it. Yeah. Right. Yes.
Why don't they make bread like?
Okay. All right. You ask a legitimate question. I have to say that in all probability, because the average person could not afford a real oven. Okay. If they could afford a real oven, or if a group of them would, let's say, have a community oven, that's one thing, okay? But in your own private home, if you wanted to do something, what did they do? They made it out of stone or earthenware, whatever they were able to do, and they made an oven. Lo and behold, it's an oven, okay? Put a fire in there and fought things. The different types that they had. Gemara and Shabbos discusses, you know, different types of ovens that they had. Yeah, obviously, it had to be something like that, right?
Joshua's
around
1950, you put these things
into
the hallways.
Yeah.
That's going on there.
Could be, could be.
I know,
Linda saw it. Oh, I see, all right. Yeah. So I guess they were still carrying on a tradition of that sort over there, back in Georgia.
They all fixed up homes, they put these hallways.
Right. Well, talking about Georgia, the former Soviet Union. Not Atlanta.
Georgia, come on.
Okay. Yeah, my father, I remember. I mean, when I was a little boy. That was the only place. We had no steam heat. We didn't even have electricity in those days. We had gas for illumination, I remember. But we had a coal oven in the kitchen. That's what they used for cooking and everything else. And in the wintertime, right, my father would sleep on top of it on a cold day or something, right? I still have a memory of the day that they finally came and they installed electric in the house. No, in Harlem. In Harlem. I was born in Harlem, sure. Yeah.
This was in the 20s?
Yeah. Yeah. I would say probably sometime like 1925 or something like that. No, it wasn't. Yeah, we had gas light. That we had. But we did not have a gas stove. We did not have a gas stove. We had a coal stove.
Like that.
When did oil come in?
When did oil come in? That was for the Reicha people. I mean, look.
They had kerosene, but that wasn't really oil.
No. I remember poverty.
I think in the 1930s when they began to discover oil.
Yeah. No, actually, oil had been discovered before, but it's
used. Everybody was using coal.
For home heating, people were actually using coal more than anything else. And that after the temple was destroyed, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai made certain enactments because he wanted to carry on traditions that had existed in the Beis HaMikdash itself. He wanted to keep alive the idea that the temple would be rebuilt and also that the things that had taken place in the temple, in the Beis HaMikdash, would again be observed. And of course, the first thing that we learned in the Mishnah at the beginning is that in the Beis HaMikdash, if Rosh Hashanah was Shabbos, they would blow shofar over there. Okay?
Right.
So that therefore, this is what he wanted to do. Also, in Yavne, where he had his yeshiva, his house of learning, and also his best in over there. All right. So Tanu Rabbanan, our sages taught us as follows. Well, if you have Tanu Rabbanan, it means that they're always quoting a beraisa, you know, one of the statements that were not part of the official Mishnah, but were by the great sages of the Mishnah, and therefore they have a great deal of authority. And very often they help to elaborate or, give us reasons for what the Mishnah was driving at. Okay. So our sages taught us, Pa'amachas, it happened one time, that Chol Rosh Hashanah liyos b'Shabbos. Rosh Hashanah happened to occur on Shabbos. Okay. Now, in the brackets it says, V'hoyu kol ha'orim miskansim, which probably doesn't belong at this particular point, but at any rate, it means that the places that surrounded Yavne, the people came from those places into Yavne in order to hear the blowing of the shofar. Okay? The reason why it's in brackets is probably because, actually, this comes from a somewhat later statement about the difference between Yerushalayim and other towns. Okay? All right. Which was also mentioned in the Mishnah. So, at any rate, at this particular occasion, so Amar Lahem Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai of Bnei B'Seira. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said to the Bnei B'Seira, the sons of B'Seira, who happened to be great scholars in their own right, and he said to him, Niska, let's blow shofar. Amar Lo, so they said to him, Nodun, let's think about it. Let's decide in our judgment whether it's the right thing or not. Omar Lahem, so he said to him, Niska, first let's blow shofar, v'yachakach nodun, and after that, we will think about it. First blow shofar, and then we'll think whether it's right or not. So, v'achat shatoku, so after they blew shofar, Omar Lo, so they said to him, nodun, all right, now let's go and think about it, whether it's right or wrong and so on to do it. So, Omar Lahem, so he said to him, look, the shofar has already been heard in Yavne. It's already gone. And you don't go and call back something like this, which already has taken place.
Documentally.
Right. Omer Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Elazar now says the following. He says, Lo hiskin Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai ela bil Yavne bilvad. He says that the enactment that was made by Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai applied only to Yavne, to the yeshiva, the bezdin that was there. Omulo, so the other sages said to Rabbi Elazar, they said to him, echad yavde, the echad kamokam sheish bebezdin. No, it makes no difference. What applied to yavde also applies equally to any place where there is a bezdin. Okay. So theoretically, if there was a city with a bezdin, it would be permitted to blow shofar on Shabbos. From a practical point of view, however, I have to tell you that no city is considered qualified enough, not even Yerushalayim, because we don't have the Sanhedrin, you see, that's the reason why. Okay? So, except in the Reformed Temple, we don't blow shofar on Shabbos. They tell me that Sinai was packed this year, they had two services. Yeah, that's what I heard. Yeah. Well, that's also good. It's a lot easier to be a Sinai member than it is to be a member of the Shul, which believes in Jewish tradition. Okay. All right. Oberlo, so they said to him, Hainu Tanakama. So they said to him, so where do you have a difference between the first statement that says that they would blow on Shabbos in the Beis HaMikdash, or in in Yavne, but not Lo Bamedina, which means but not in other places outside the area? So he says, how does your interpretation differ from them? So he says, Ikor Benayahu says there is one difference between the first statement at the beginning of the Mishnah and mine. Says, Beit Dino da Akrai. It may simply be a court which happens to get together for some emergency session, but it's not a real acting bezdin, at all times that it's in action. Okay, so that would be the difference.
That implies that the bezdin was always in session.
Pardon me?
The bezdin was always there.
There were towns which always had a permanent bezdin, okay? But this is not a permanent bezdin. If there's no permanent bezdin, then in that particular case, you don't blow shofar over there. But if it had a permanent bezdin, then according to this authority, it would be permissible to blow. But again, as I say, this was all true in the days of the Beis HaMikdash, right? Or in the period immediately following the Beis HaMikdash. But today, as you're all aware of the fact,
we don't
blow it, okay? In other words, we follow what we have at the beginning of the Mishnah, which says that if Yontif of Rosh Hashanah occurred on Shabbos, then in the Beis HaMikdash they did blow shofar, but outside, by Medina, right? Lo Lo Medina, not outside. Okay. All right. Then they said to him, Omru Lo, they said to him, Echad Yavdim Echad Kamokim Yishuv Beisdin. He said, it makes no difference whether it's Yavdim or any other place, whether it's a permanent Beisdin. So, to this, we have a statement by Rav Huna. Omar Rav Huna. This is the next page. Okay, pass. All right. So, Omar Rav Huna said, and he said something that I have to tell you is a little bit enigmatic. What did he say? He said, the imbezdin, and with a bezdin. So they say, nu, sotaka, my the imbezdin, what do you mean, and with a bezdin?
No.
So he explains, no, what I meant is bifne bezdin, right? In other words, what I meant to say is that it's only permitted to blow shofar on Shabbos if you are actually present in the presence of the bezdin. Bifne bezdin, okay?
No,
you're going to the right page.
You have to on this page. This is where I'm going to now. That's last week. You gave out the wrong page.
Gave out
the wrong page.
I think this is the page. Yeah, that one.
It should say the imbezdin. If not, let me take. Okay. The statement of Rav Huna is enigmatic because what does it mean? And with a bezdin. So the explanation that he gives is what I mean is bifne bezdin. In other words, in the presence of a place where there is a permanent bezdin, there in that particular place, it is permitted to blow shofar on Shabbos, Rosh Hashanah. Okay? But if it would not be, right, lafuki, this is to exclude shalom bifne bezdin, where you are not in the actual presence of the bezdin. The low, right?
Yeah.
No. All right. So, Masiv Rava. So, Rava asked the following question. He says, Yeah, but look, take a look. We have another statement going back to the Mishnah on the previous page. That's why it's good to have the previous page too in front of you, so we can refer back again to the Mishnah, right? It said over there, the Yod Zos, and likewise in this matter, Hoyesor Yerushalayim Yisera Al Yav. Yerushalayim had a higher status than Yav. So, why don't I quote the rest of the Mishnah over there so you know what we're talking about in case you don't have the sheet in front of you. It said over there that Shekol Ir Shehi Roa V'Shamaz Zekrova V'Yekona Lovo Token. It says any place, any city which can see Jerusalem, which can hear, which is near, where people can come to it, right? So there, Tokin, in those places, you are permitted also to blow. In other words, in the environs of Yerushalayim, if it's close enough to hear the blowing from Yerushalayim, or if it's close enough to see Yerushalayim, and so on and so forth, then in that case, you would also be permitted to blow shofar over there, right? And then the Mishnah concluded by saying, But in Yavda lo hoyu token elu bebezdin bevad. In Yavda they blew only in the bezdin itself. Okay?
In the bezdin.
In the bezdin. This is what the Mishnah says. Okay? So they're going back again now to the statement that we have on Lada of the Talmud. Okay? Where they say, okay, what does it mean, my ode, the ode, and likewise, right? The ode sounds. So he says, e lema. If you say that it means kinikatane, right, as we have already said, then in that particular case, zos miboile. So it should have said simply, and this is the rule, and so on and so forth. Ela, Yerushalayim tokin yechidin. So what does it mean that there was a superiority that Yerushalayim had? So this we know, in other words, it says the Mishnah spoke about what superiority, whether they could see the area or hear it and so on and so forth. But there's another area, he says, which is not mentioned in the Mishnah, but what is the other area? He says, Yerushalayim token yechidin. In Yerushalayim, even the individuals were able, that is, every person was able to blow a shofar privately, okay? This was the superiority of Yerushalayim. Well, the Yavne ain't token yechid. But in Yavne, the individuals did not blow shofar. Okay?
On what basis did they make that decision?
It was to enhance the idea of the mitzvah of blowing shofar in Yerushalayim, even if it was on Shabbos. Okay? As we said before, because this fell into the category of chokhmah, right, and not melacha. So that therefore, technically, there was no violation of Shabbos that was involved, provided you blew in your own home. Didn't carry it in the street, you had your own shofar, right. You blew it. So that would be permissible, he said, okay? Well, the Yavne, but Yavne ain't token yechidim. Their private division is not. So now, the Gemara challenges that statement too. The Hor. But behold, he says, he also Rav Yitzchok Bar Yosef, and Rav Yitzchok Bar Yosef came. Whenever it says when he came, it means that he came from Israel to Babylonia, and he reported, you know, what he saw in Eretz Israel, what he heard in Eretz Israel.
Of course, this is the Babylonian text.
Right, this is the Babylonian Talmud. Right. So Omar, so he said, you know, he says, Ki Misayin Shalicha de Tzibura Tekiya B'Yavne Lo shama inish kol one mikol tekiya diyachidoy. It says, when the shliach tzibur, in other words, the person who blew the shofar for the congregation, when he finished blowing in Yavda, no person could hear anything with his ears because the noise was so dense from what? From the fact that everybody started to blow, all the individuals started to blow shofar. So you couldn't hear yourself think or talk of anything like that. That's what he means.
This
he says
was in Yavda,
right. This was in Yavda, he says, this happened. So Elo. So So if that's the case, then how do you explain the difference between Yerushalayim and Yavne? So he gives a different difference. He says, El Olav, but rather it says, the Yerushalayim token bein bisman bezdin uvein shalo bisman bezdin. Uvi Yavne bisman bezdin in shalo bisman bezdin lo. Which means as follows. He says, in Yerushalayim, they would blow shofar whether it was at a time that the Besdin normally meets or not. Now, when did the Besdin normally meet? The answer is they normally met in the morning until Chatzos, until midday, okay? So, in Yerushalayim, they could blow not just up to midday, but they could also blow even later in the day. Of course, the mitzvah of blowing the shofar on Rosh Hashanah is that if you haven't had a chance to blow it, the mitzvah min hamu, of course, we would say, in other words, the finest way to do it is to do it as soon as you possibly can, okay? But if you can't do it at that time, then kol hayom kosher, right? In other words, the entire daytime is kosher for the blowing of shofar. So if they didn't have a chance to blow in the morning when the Besdin would normally meet, so they could do it even after that time, in Yerushalayim. But he says, the Yavne, right, Bisman Besdin, in, at the time when the Besdin would normally meet, it was permissible, even for Yechidim, even for, you know, individuals to blow. But Shalom Bisman Besdin, no. But at the time when the Besdin is no longer in session normally, then they were not permitted to blow. Hob is bond bestin, but nevertheless, right, what is the conclusion? As long as it was the time when the Besdin was in session, Mihon, however, right, token, they are permitted to blow, right? Vafilu shalom if they Besdin. Lo. Did I skip something?
Yeah.
Mihon token. Vafilu shalom if they Besdin, lo. But, right. But nevertheless, you know, if it was not at the time when the Besdin met, then in that case they were not. Whereas the Ilum Yerushalayim, but on the contrary, in Yerushalayim, token they did blow shofar, bein bifnei Besdin, whether it was at the time when the Besdin would normally meet, or bein shalom bifnei Besdin, or at the time when they did not meet, or be Yavne, and Yavne bifnei Besdin in, shalom bifnei Besdin lo. So he's repeating that this is my conclusion, right, that in Yerushalayim you can blow it at any time during the day, whether it's a time that the Besdin normally would meet or not. Whereas in Yavne, no, only at the time when the Besdin would normally meet. Ika Damaste, there are those who will give a different interpretation altogether, Lohoda Rav Huna, to what Rav Huna said. Or in connection with the pasuk that is written, and it says, "Vayom Hakipurim Taviru Shofar Beor Bechol Arzachem." This is a reference, if you remember, to the Jubilee. This has nothing to do with Rosh Hashanah, but with the Jubilee, it says that on Yom Kippur of the Jubilee year, you are to cause the shofar to be sounded throughout your land. Now, obviously, if the shofar is to be sounded throughout the land, the implication is that people everywhere in the land of Israel are permitted to blow shofar on Yom Kippur and Jubilee, right? Melamed, it teaches us, he says, Shekol Yochid, the Yochid, Chayav Nitzko, he says. This teaches us that every single individual on that particular occasion is obligated to blow shofar. So Omar Rav Huna. So Rav Huna said, the Besdin. You know, those magic words that we have at the top of the page. Right. This is what he said, that the Besdin. My the Besdin. So he says, this Bon Besdin. La Fuki Shalom is Bon Besdin. Delo. Again, the same explanation that we had further up, only now he applies it to what? To the blowing of the shofar on Jubilee year. Right. That if it is when the Besdin is in session, then they permit it to blow. But at a time when the Besdin is not in session, then they do not. So Masif Rava, so the third Rava objected. He said, Tikias Rosh Hashanah the Yovel Doches HaShabbos the Gevulet. Okay? Ish Uvesa. Okay. So it says on Rosh Hashanah and also in Jubilee year, right, they push aside the Shabbos, right? In other words, they take precedence over Shabbos in that what? That it would be permitted to blow shofar, correct? Bigulin Ishuveso, even outside of the temple precincts, and this applies to every person and his household. So they say, my Ishuveso, what do you mean when he says Ishuveso? So he says, Ilemo, if you say Ishvi Ishto, that every man, every woman blows the shofar, well, he says, Itso Bimechaiva, is a woman obligated to blow shofar? The whole mitzvah's ashesha is mangramahu. Isn't this the kind of a mitzvah which is dependent upon time, a certain time for the fulfillment, and from that a woman is excused? And we learned, you know, the whole mitzvah's ashesha is mangramahu.